From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Quick, what first comes to mind when you hear the word navigator? Is it someone with a compass or a sextant? Well, Tristan Gooley thinks about the word in a more basic way. He says, all of us are navigators. In fact, he says, navigation begins the moment we wake up. Gooley is a writer, a walker, an adventurer, and one of the things he does is teach people how to find their way just by paying attention to nature. Sure, these days we have technology to get us places, but Gooley says naturally navigating the world opens it up to us in different and important ways. But you have to pay attention to puddles and rocks and leaves and tracks. Tristan Gooley is with us today to talk about the lost art of natural navigation. Join us after the news.
Hey, you. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The role of the navigator in society has taken a hit over the years as technology has made it easier to find our way. Pretty much all of us have a remarkably sophisticated navigation device with us everywhere we go. And Tristan Gooley wonders what that means for our relationship with the natural world. Gooley is a writer, and he's also an adventurer. He's led expeditions on five continents. He's walked from Scotland to London. He's climbed mountains. He also has this distinction in his bio, the only living person to have both flown and sailed across the Atlantic by himself. And Gooley is committed to recovering the lost art of natural navigation, which is finding your way by nature, by paying attention to the shape of the land, the pattern in the water, the bend of the trees, the stuff growing on the rocks. All of that, he says, can point you in the right direction. But if our phone can also point us in the right direction, what's the point? It's one of the questions we'll be talking with Tristan Gooley about today. Tristan Gooley is joining us, and welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I guess I wanted to begin with the question of whether or not you've always been, from when you were first young, a wanderer.
Yeah, I think I was restless from the earliest days I can remember. I'd often see a hill and think it'd be more fun at the top, or see a lake and think, how do I get to the other side? But one thing I've really noticed change over the decades is that the goal was very, you know, inevitably an immature one when I was a kid. It was as simple as that. Hey, I want to get to the top of something. And the hills became mountains, and it became technically more difficult to get to the top of them. But philosophically, the change has been much more dramatic than the physical change, because it's, over the years I've gone from, you know, very simple, perhaps even, you know, ridiculously macho goals to sort of thinking much more about what happens between the A and the B. And that has come to shape my work and my life.
What, can you pinpoint a particular moment when you started to make that transition?
Well, I started with journeys which probably only took 10 minutes to plan, as in, right, I'm going to climb over that fence, and that's going to get me to where I want to go to. And I ended up with this goal of wanting to cross the Atlantic solo by air and sea. And that took 7 years of planning, training, preparation. And over those 7 years, something strange happened, which was that I'd set myself this, in physical and geographical terms, quite big goal. And the strange thing was that during those 7 years, a lot of the training I was doing were expeditions to build my skill levels and competence. And what I was finding is that the satisfaction I was getting from those bigger and bolder journeys wasn't getting any greater. In fact, there was a quite staggering diminishing return. So some of the journeys I'd done as a 10-year-old felt far more satisfying and weirdly exciting than some of the ones I was doing in my late 20s and early 30s. And so there was quite a dramatic reversal, where I remember a couple of journeys that are perhaps only 1 or 2 miles long, walking in the English countryside, where I thought, right, I'm going to try and cross this little patch of woodland just using the trees as my compass or just using the stars and feeling exactly like I had done as a kid again. There was a sense of, you know, I'm not going to die here, but can I do it? And it was, for want of a better expression, it was a kiddie thrill. And then, you know, a few weeks later, I was strapping myself in with some, you know, massive harness and immersion suit to climb into a light aircraft and stare down from, you know, 15,000 feet at an awful lot of blue, and weirdly not feeling the same thrill. So over those 7 years, it happened not overnight, but it felt quite dramatic.
How do you describe the difference between, I mean, it seems like on one hand, there's a kind of euphoria in that simpler experience. I mean, what's the difference, do you think? Have you figured that out?
Well, I think we are, all of us, I guess it's an evolutionary thing. We're all programmed to have that pure joy, that euphoria that comes from learning something and then proving to ourselves that we're capable of doing it. And I really don't think it matters which field this is in. You know, it could be music, it could be cooking. It's something we experience hourly, not even daily, but hourly as children. And then we all reach a point in our perhaps our 20s where it's only happening maybe once a week, where you know, oh yeah, I can do that. And so to rekindle that, natural navigation is a fantastic tool for that, because we're going back to basics. And something as simple as finding the North Star is very, very simple. It takes less than a minute to learn how to do it. But you go out there, you find the North Star, and then the thing everybody does, I certainly did this the first time many years ago now, but the first time I did it, is you get out a compass or these days a smartphone or something else, and you corroborate it. So you know you're looking at the North Star, and you know the North Star's north, but you use a bit of technology, right, whether it's very old or very new, you use a bit of technology to prove that you've done something. And that's an exciting moment. But then something really exciting happens, which is you start to realize that the star's more dependable than the extraordinary piece of electronics in your hand. And that's, you know, those two things are not identical, but they're part of that kind of modern proving to ourselves that we can still learn something and that these ancient skills still work.
You say the history of human navigation is mostly concerned with the question of how. And we'll get into that as we go along. But you say a better way to start may be with the question why. I wanted you to say something about that, you know, the idea of why we travel.
Yeah, I think we have to question our motive for any action if we want to understand what we can derive from that action. So if the aim is to get to a meeting, you know, without being late, to cross, you know, 30 miles of the country for a meeting that starts in, you know, 35 minutes, and if you're late, you know, your whole livelihood's going to be jeopardized. The aim there is very clear, and you're not going to, you know, be able to derive a huge amount of pleasure from noticing that the wildflowers are only growing on the south side of the road as you hammer along it. But if the aim of a journey is to learn more about ourselves or learn more about a place, which is, you know, perhaps some people would describe that as the difference between maybe a holiday, a difference between a vacation and travel, then natural navigation has a huge amount to offer, because it stops us from going through things and it forces us to quite literally stop and look around. And that's when, you know, the shape of a rock can help you find north or south, but it's not, it might not even be north or south that you're deriving from that. It's noticing the rock in the first place. And that's just one of the many things in the rich tapestry all around us that most of us, myself included, miss in most journeys. But if we use natural navigation, it's much more likely that we're going to notice things.
If we go back many thousands of years, do we know anything about how prehistoric humans navigated? Do we have any physical evidence?
Well, it's to be honest, it's frustrating and tantalizing at the same time, because the physical evidence we have proves that human beings had reached most major land masses as early as 10,000 years ago. And, you know, there's archaeological evidence and there's genetic evidence and all sorts of things. And our picture of how humans migrated around the world is coming on in leaps and bounds, mainly because of genetic analysis. You know, up until quite recently, people were having to put together bits of pottery and make, you know, educated guesses in terms of, you know, how that technology was moving around the world. And then the geneticists, as they always do, come along and play their trump card and go, yeah, you guys got it mostly right, but we can sort of add about, you know, what you've managed over the last 200 years. We can sort of, we can manage that over the next sort of 5 years. So we've got a very clear picture of you know, where and quite often when. But there's very, very little evidence of the navigational skills because instruments are much, much more recent. We don't know exactly when the first instruments were created, but human beings have found their way to you know, most pockets of the Earth that are habitable long before even something as rudimentary as the compass or something even more basic, an instrument called the Kamal, which... you can make a Kamal at home in 10 minutes as a sort of like homeschool project type thing. You just get a piece of card or a piece of wood and a piece of string. And the string measures how far the piece of wood is from your mouth. So you hold onto one end of the string with a knot in it between your teeth. And then that block of wood is measuring an angle. And that can help you work out how high a star is above the horizon. The North Star, for example, the angle of the North Star above your horizon is your latitude. So somebody can learn how to navigate reasonably accurately in 10 minutes with technology that a 5-year-old could make.
It's interesting. In one of your books, you write about that what we know about the earliest navigators, and you've said that ancient myths shouldn't be discounted, that they can tell us something about the way ancient people navigated. Would you say something about that? I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, the thing that I think navigation as an art is so extraordinarily underestimated, because something I say when I give talks is I say to the audience, I say, I may not know you as individuals, but I'm prepared to wager that every single person here in the past 24 hours has eaten something, drunk something, slept, and navigated. And people sometimes sort of question that last bit initially until you say, well, by navigating, I mean, it starts by deciding which side of bed to get out of. You know, because people associate the word navigation with something, you know, bold or big scale. But to me, you know, the side of the road you choose to walk down is a navigational choice. And so what we find is with all fundamental parts of being human, We find those things woven through the great stories. I sometimes joke that if you want to be taken seriously as a poet, you have to refer to the North Star, because if you look at all the great poets, if you look at all the great poets over the past 1,000 years, they slip it in there somewhere. You know, Shakespeare, Milton, they're all at it. But it's not a coincidence, because what we find is if we look at any of the great stories, they will tell us something about the civilization that they spring from. They'll tell us something about what they're eating, what they're drinking. They'll even tell us a bit about their sleeping habits, and they'll certainly tell us lots about their travel and their navigation. So, you know, just to give you an example of a story everybody's come across, at least in passing, the Odyssey. Odysseus keeps the constellation of Arctos, the bear, on his left. That's a northern constellation, so if it's on your left, you know, you're heading from west to east. And that's just one of literally thousands of examples of how we can look at these stories and get an insight into how they saw journeys. I mean, I've undertaken a research expedition based very much on the thing you're asking about there, in the sense that the Norse sagas, the incredible stories of how the Vikings lived and found their way from place to place, include a reference of how to get from Norway to Greenland. And again, we've got to remember that this is a story. These are not travel or sailing directions, but sewn within them are clues. So, in the saga I'm thinking of, the story sort of says, you know, when you're going on this journey from Norway to Greenland, you need to go far enough south that you lose sight of Iceland, but not so far south that you lose sight of the coast-seeking birds or the whales. And there, for me, you know, when I came across that sort of happy alarm bells ringing. That's a red rag to a natural navigation bull, if you like. And so I set off on an expedition up into the North Atlantic to prove that method works.
You wrote a paper about that called Nature's Radar, And at least I'm thinking this is that expedition, is it not?
That's right. That's exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just going to mention the UK military condensed your paper into a few lines. I wanted to read them because I think they're incredibly succinct. Here it is. If you count more than 10 birds in a random 5-minute period, you are within 45 miles of land. If you count two or fewer birds, then you are more than 40 miles from land. And in between, you can't be sure.
Yeah, that's it. If you see any British military aircraft anywhere in the world, they should have a flip chart on board, and it's a survival aid memoir for if things go wrong and they find themselves in a survival situation. And it includes a lot of useful tidbits. My initial research paper, which people can find online on my website, naturalnavigator.com, there's the whole research paper's up there. It's 8,000 words long, as I recall, an awful lot of data in it. And it proves it's one of those strange research projects where you're fairly certain the thing you're trying to prove is true. But until you go and do something that's rather testing, you can't say it's true, that the Viking method worked. And yes, the military boiled all that blood, sweat and research tears down into a couple of lines. And I was delighted they did.
So there's this revolution in the technology, of course. You've called it the seismic change. And I wanted to get your sense of what it means. I mean, one of the things you've explored in your books is the changing role of the navigator, you know, in different cultures and societies. It seems we don't really pay much attention to those skills anymore, I guess for natural reasons. But what are the implications of that, do you think?
Well, I find it culturally fascinating. I'm bound to be a little bit biased as a professional navigator. I notice when I read accounts where the navigator in a society is given, you know, a modicum of respect. No, I'm only joking. It's you know, there are very few full-time navigators in today's society. And you can occasionally see the shift happen. I mean, a good example is in commercial airliners. There used to be a dedicated navigator, but that role doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, it's similar with other roles. There used to be a dedicated engineer, and in fighter aircraft, you still occasionally get navigators, but their job is more and more being gobbled away by electronics. But if we look at, we have to go to different parts of the world where the changes have been more recent. So places like the Pacific Ocean is fascinating as a sort of case study in this area, because until many European navigators started encountering the indigenous populations there in the 18th century, there was little or no contact with external civilizations. And what that means is the ancient hierarchical view of navigation was sort of frozen in time, in a sense, and we get a glimpse there of this interesting hierarchy, some of which is very familiar to Western students of history. So you have a royalty, you have a chief or a prince or a king, and then you have a level below that. We can think of it like a caste system, and on that level below, quite often we have individuals like priests, but also the navigator. And that's, to me, that's very interesting, because the priest is dealing with the metaphysical thorny issues around life and death, and the navigator is dealing with the physical. So, you know, before you get in a boat and set off over the horizon, you want to make sure, you know, you've done right by the priest, and then you do as you're told by the navigator, and you get those two right, then hopefully you're going to survive the journey. And if you don't, you've squared your account there as well, if you see what I mean. But now navigation is seen as a purely functional thing. It's not seen as anything close to as important or fundamental as that view.
When we come back from a break, we'll talk about sort of how you get started if you want to naturally navigate your world. Tristan Gooley is with us, the author of several books about natural navigation, including The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs and his latest, How to Read Water. We'll talk about that one too. Also, we have a link to his website on our website, naturalnavigator.com. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Thank you. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a real-life adventurer is with us, Tristan Gooley, who has with us to talk about how to navigate the world naturally. Gooley is committed to recovering this lost art of natural navigation, finding your way by nature. He is the author of a number of books, among them The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs and his newest, which is How to Read Water. So I wanted to ask about how you think about natural navigation. And this was the question I wondered more than anything. Like, do you take a GPS with you on these trips just in case? Or do you think about that as cheating or at least depriving you of the kind of genuine sense of that experience?
I tend to over-equip and underuse. I understand this sort of idea that, well, if you've got the GPS with you, then you're not naturally navigating. But I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm not some sort of Houdini of natural navigation where you drop me in the middle of nowhere and that sort of. To me, it's a more day to day thing. It's something that adds a layer of fascination and insight to our daily journeys. Yes, it can be used for the more extreme ones, and I've done a few of those over the years. But it's a much more interesting subject when it's applied in a supplementary way to daily life. So, if I give you an example, imagine these days we're all sort of ingrained to kind of check messages and emails and all sorts of stuff, on our phone. So if you're in that situation where you've got to kill 10 minutes, you're waiting for a bus or a train or a meeting start or whatever it is, I think we all default to kind of like, oh, let's see if somebody's got in touch. If instead of doing that, or if instead, just before doing that, you just look out of a window or look out across a train platform or a bus station or whatever it is, and just ask yourself the question, which way am I looking? North, south, east, west, in between one of them. It doesn't matter if you're right or wrong, but if you ask yourself a question and don't look at your phone to answer it, you suddenly have to, you notice the sun's there. You go, well, I know the sun's going to tell me the answer, but what is it? And you suddenly realize that, our ancestors, and really not very long ago, they wouldn't have even had to think about it. The sun is due south in the middle of the day. And once you've tuned into that a few times, you realize, okay, yeah, I'm not having to look at my phone to work out that I'm looking south. And then the next level is interpreting what I call the footprints in a landscape. So, the sun and the wind and the water are leaving signs all around us. There are 19 different ways to navigate just using a tree because it reacts to the environment. And when we know how the environment behaves, a tree is both a compass and part of a map for us. So that's really how I see us getting into this. I wouldn't want anyone listening to think this is part of the big tool bag for people who are interested in survival and exploration only. It certainly is that, but that's a very small part of the natural navigation appeal. Most of the people who enjoy my books and natural navigation more generally are just curious, open-minded folk who find the outdoors as interesting as indoors. And that's the only qualification, really.
You say, and this is kind of a theme in I think in pretty much all of the books where you write about reading nature's signs, the importance of deduction. Talk about that role, because it seems like that's an important place to start, the idea of deduction, which we apply in crime novels and things like that, but you say we don't often apply it to the natural world.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, because for me it was a penny drop moment in the sense that I was doing things in parallel. I was, researching in both an outdoors physical sense and indoors in an academic sense, all of these different techniques, and that's part of my work is like. Like a magpie going around collecting different things and seeing what works. And if it really works and I find it's helpful, I work it into my books and my work generally. But that's, that's sitting alongside. The reason it's sort of triggering excitement in me and then hopefully the people who enjoy natural navigation as well is because it's the synapses in our brain that have evolved to enjoy deduction. And what was happening to me is I'd do that for, it might be a long day and I'd sort of get in at 8 or 9 in the evening and then I'd sort of, maybe read a crime novel, as you say, or turn on and, I like many, many people, used to enjoy Columbo and things like that. And this is, the two things are very closely related, although I didn't realize it for a few years. Our brains have evolved to solve puzzles. Everything from, you know, crosswords to suspense films to, you know, if we look at the way we spend a lot of our leisure time, we find that it's that part of our brain that we're trying to exercise and tickle. And the weird thing for me was that over the past 30, 40 years in particular, this silent assumption has become pervasive, where we believe that part of our brain wants to switch off the moment we step outside. So somebody could watch, you know, four, go on a sort of box set binge, as we call it here. You may call it something similar or different, but, you know, you watch four episodes of the latest, you know, whether it's Breaking Bad or something like that, and your brain's getting, you know, is loving the ride because it's having to solve the puzzle. Oh, are they going to catch that person? Are they going to work this out? You know, how is the detective going to crack this one? And that same person, which has included me, will then step out the door, you know, and not be aware that there's a much richer, more fascinating puzzle in every single landscape we see, whether it's the center of a big city or a patch of wilderness and everything in between. So it was really exciting for me when I realized why I was enjoying it. And also, if I'm honest, why it was being picked up and enjoyed by so many other people.
The importance of the senses is another theme that comes out in your books. You say in The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs that picking up one simple scent can take the mind on an extraordinary journey. And I wanted you to maybe explain this with using the example of inversions, because in this part of Utah, we get stuck in really terrible air inversions during the winter. So I think people can relate. What do you look for in an inversion? The sense of a smell, that you can smell an inversion, was fascinating.
Yeah, I use that example to open this whole area in that book, as you say, and I'll explain that example. If we wake up and we go outside and it's a cool morning, you know, maybe late autumn or winter, and we pick up the scent of what I describe as musty smoke, by which I mean we all know what smoke from a fire nearby smells like. It's very pungent, sometimes acrid, particularly if there are any plastics or anything involved. But our, you know, we've evolved to be really quite refined. You know, we know if there's a fire nearby, it's a very distinct smell. But if there's a fire further away and that smoke gets mixed with the air more generally, but doesn't escape, it creates this sort of this musty, smoky smell. It's almost like a stale, smoky smell. And you don't smell it and go, you don't start looking around, you see where the fire is, which you would do if you smelt a bonfire or a forest fire that's nearby. So at that point, we stop and we go, why? Why are we smelling the smell sometimes and not others? And that question is key. So what happens in a temperature inversion, as it sounds like many of your listeners will know, is we get this strange flipping of the atmosphere where we're all, I think, comfortable with the idea that the higher you go, the colder the air gets. That's why we get snow-capped mountaintops, but it can be, you know, quite pleasant at the base of the mountain. And that's sort of normal atmospheric conditions. But occasionally that gets flipped and we get a layer of warm air trapping a layer of cool air near the ground. And it is very, very common in late autumn and early winter in particular. And when that happens, we get a sandwich effect, because we've got the ground, then we've got this layer of cold air, then we've got the warm air. And what happens is the fires, and they may be, you know, a very long way away, depending what the wind's doing. You know, they may even be 100 miles away. It's unlikely to be that far, but they can be quite far away. And this smoke gets caught up in the sandwich and mixed, and it creates this musty effect. So when we smell the smoke, once we're familiar with that connection, we go, okay, there's a temperature inversion. Sometimes it's visible. Sometimes you can see it in the layers of mist and cloud and things, but quite often it's not. So that smell triggers, okay, we've got an inversion, which triggers a sort of a domino effect of thought processes. Because if there's a temperature inversion, we will hear things that are much further away than we can normally hear. Because just like the smoke, sounds get trapped in that layer. Not just sounds, but light too. So everything we see in the distance is bent in a slightly different way in a temperature inversion. Typically, you only really notice it with things over water or perhaps sunrises or sunsets. So I think everybody's familiar with the idea that the sun can look a little bit squashed from top to bottom. It's almost like something's sat on top of it at a sunset. But if there's a temperature inversion, you'll see the sun stretch vertically. So instead of looking like something sat on it, it looks like somebody's taken the top and the bottom and pulled it up and down a little bit. And that, again, leads to other things like the green flash, which is this moment where you can just sometimes just see a split second, you see a bit of green light as the sun goes down. And that's much more common during a temperature inversion. Sometimes you see things levitating over water, a phenomenon known as a Fata Morgana, a lovely Italian name based on the idea of a floating fairy. I could go on, but I think you get the idea that, you know, so we've just picked up some musty smoke. The modern brain wants to, you know, shut that out because it's thinking about emails and deadlines and all sorts of other things. But the ancient brain would be thinking, okay, now's a good time to have a listen for you know, what's going on around me, because I'll be able to hear things several miles away that I wouldn't normally.
How do you explain to people how to get started? Because you say in your book that it's best to take each component in turn. You know, there's the ground, there's the sky, there's the plants, there's the animals. But where do you start?
Well, I think when you're learning, that's definitely the approach I'd encourage. But equally, I wouldn't want people to lose sight of the whole. Holistic is a much overused word. But the whole purpose of taking each thing in turn is so that we can actually manage the learning process. Because the truth is, you know, in one small patch of ground, there are more natural navigation clues than our brain can cope with if we're new to it. So we can start by thinking about, okay, grass. Okay, how's that going to help me? All right, now, where does the wind normally come from? Okay, in this part of the world, let's say it comes from the west. So there's no wind today, but I know it's been blowing from the west for the last couple of days. So this grass will be bent over from west to east. I've got a compass. So there we can manage that. That's nice and straightforward. The wind, not too challenging. The grass, not too challenging. And we just build in pieces, you know, one at a time. We add maybe, you know, one a day. And suddenly what happens is we start to notice that things are connected that perhaps we never realized were. So it's almost like completing the circle. So to get started, that's what I say to people is imagine you've got kind of like a nice big sort of toolkit, but you haven't got any tools in it yet. You just add a few. Okay, the sun is due south in the middle of the day. Okay, bang, in that goes. Right, I'm going to learn something about the moon. Okay, if we draw a line that touches the horns of a crescent moon and stretch that down to the ground, that's probably going to be south. In that goes. Let's learn one thing about water. Okay, well, water radically changes the plant and animal life. So if I suddenly notice a change in insects, it's telling me something about the water, and I'm just going to notice where the water is. Bang, in that goes. And then what starts to happen is these pieces, it's like a jigsaw. And imagine you've got a board and you're starting a 1,000-piece jigsaw. There's going to come a point where you put a piece in that joins three other pieces that you didn't realize were joined initially. And that's the joy of it. But it can be daunting if we think, right, we've got to go out there and do all of this in one go. So it's just one piece at a time. And that question I mentioned earlier, you know, which way am I looking, is a really fun way to get into it, because it doesn't matter if you're wrong. You're not going to lose your life. You're not even going to lose a few seconds of your day. You just go out there, you know, once every couple of days and just say, which way am I looking? And just by trying to solve it by looking around you, you're up and running.
Mm. There's this section in one of your books where you write about the importance of sort of cultivating this habit of taking note of the character of not just the dramatic landmarks, but the less prominent landmarks. And you say that those who are really good at that are three types of people in particular. Artists are really good at it, you say. Experienced soldiers are pretty good at it. And also indigenous peoples. And there's this, you write about in one of your books about the, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, the Penan people of
the Penan, yeah.
Penan, sorry, this nomadic indigenous people in Borneo. And you've talked about how they sort of navigate just by reading, I don't know, it, like the shape of the land. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, I headed out to Borneo and got into the heart of Borneo. And it's such unforgiving terrain that it actually took 9 days traveling as fast as I could to get from the coast to the center. There was no faster way that I could find to do it. But once I got there, it wasn't about time at all. It was about learning and The Pen and Dyack are, the Dyack are, it's a collective term. It refers to perhaps 200 different tribal groups who live in the heart, in the interior of Borneo. And the Pen and Dyack are believed to be one of the most recently nomadic. So the generation who I was able to meet are now settled in villages, but their parents were nomadic. So the knowledge is still very much there, and it's still culturally part of that part of the world. And I travelled with them overland and studied exactly how they were finding their way as best I could. And it was very difficult because my usual, what I would refer to as anchors, the things that I normally expect to see. So most cultures will have some relationship, even if they don't call things north, south, east and west. You know, they might call it sunrise or sunset. You know, there's normally some sort of anchor there. But the fascinating thing with the Pen and Dyack was they had no interest in cardinal directions at all. And it took me a really long time and an awful lot of walking up and down mountains and, tough, sweaty research to work out that their compass, if you like, was uphill and downhill or upstream or downstream. And again, I was struggling with it. And we'd made camp by a river and I was trying to make a cup of tea or something like that. And I'd misplaced my lighter. And I said there were two Dyack and an interpreter slash fixer and me, so the four of us on this expedition, and I said to my interpreter who's a good friend by this point, I said, oh, what have I done with the lighter and stuff like that, and then he was asked by one of the Dyack, you know, what's going on. I couldn't understand it, but this was relayed to me later. And Titus, the Dyack man, said to my interpreter, who then pass it on to me in English, it's there just upstream of the mess tin. And now there's absolutely zero chance that anybody from any Western culture I've ever met would have pointed something out in that way. But to me, it was a real light bulb moment, because I suddenly realized that there was no moment when Titus, this phenomenal jungle navigator, wasn't seeing the landscape in terms of which way the water flowed. And that may sound not terribly practical, you know, okay, so we've worked out which way the water flows, but suddenly it helped me access what they've been doing. Because if you're walking down a gradient and you're sensitive to how that gradient's changing, it's telling you something about the shape of the valley. Knowing something about the shape of the valley is telling you something about the type of river that's at the bottom. And once you're familiar with the rivers in an area, and their navigation works on a broad familiarity, you couldn't drop them in the middle of a rainforest they've never been to and expect them to magically navigate. But they have in their head a map of all the rivers and all the streams, the way they're all flowing, the direction they're all flowing. And so just walking down a little bit of downhill to them is constantly refreshing this orientation. It's saying, oh, okay, from this gradient, I can tell that the river at the bottom is that one. I know which way it's flowing. I know it flows from village A through B and C. Therefore, they're that way, and I'm heading this way, and it all makes sense. Whereas for several days walking, I was just bewildered at their skill, and I certainly couldn't emulate it to anywhere near their levels now, but I can at least theoretically understand what they're doing.
Tristan Gooley is with us. He's an explorer and an expert on natural navigation. His latest book is called How to Read Water, Clues and Patterns from Puddles to the Sea. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Tristan Gooley. He's an explorer, an expert on natural navigation. We're talking about some of the information in a number of his books. His latest, though, is called How to Read Water, Clues and Patterns from Puddles to the Sea. I want to talk about water, because you deal with this, of course, in your latest book. And you say that most books about water treat it as a container. But you don't really see it that way. You treat it as a subject. I wanted you to explain the difference.
Well, it's potentially a fine point, but it is, you're absolutely right. It is a key point to the approach to this book. So if we just take one example, if something like a fish disturbs the surface of the water, that has been written about by keen fishing people for you know 100 years maybe. I approach this book by saying it's not the pattern on the water telling us that the fish is there that's interesting. It's knowing what the fish is doing and therefore enabling us to predict the pattern we're going to see on the water. Now, that sounds like a very subtle thing, and it sounds like we're not doing anything new, but I'm just giving you one example there of where actually it's the pattern on the water that we're, if you like, hunting. And I describe it as the sport of rise watching, that once you understand how the insects behave, the fact they're sensitive to whether the sun goes behind a cloud, the way water flows, the fact that there's a part of the stream that's fastest called the thalweg, you bring all of these pieces together, then you understand a bit about how the fish behaves, and you say to yourself, okay, the sun's gone behind a cloud. Now these insects are going to fall out of the sky because they can't survive in shade. They're going to land on the water. I know where they're going to congregate because those bubbles there have told me. I know where the fish is going to be sheltering. It's going to be just behind that rock. We start bringing all those pieces together and we say, okay, I would expect the fish to go for one of these insects about there. You point at the water and suddenly you see ripples emanating. That's the rise of the fish. But it's the ripples that are confirming that we've tuned into this incredible network of connected things in the environment. And the fish is just one part of it. And it's the pattern that has unlocked it all for us.
So in that sense, it's about more than just navigation. I mean, it's about, as you put it in your book, it's wholeheartedly about nature. Navigation is about nature. It's about finding those connections.
Yeah, and that's another really good question, because natural navigation, when people are unfamiliar with the concept, it's totally sort of understandable that people go, well, this is purely practical. Okay, so I use the North Star. I travel for 10 miles using the North Star. I'm going to have gone 10 miles north. That's the start and the end of it, isn't it? Well, actually, natural navigation takes on an infinitely more rich and fascinating aura, effectively, if we think it's more about map making than direction. So I strongly recommend, if people are new to it, they have a lot of fun proving, you know, to themselves and then if they want to their mates, that they can find north, south, east and west using insects, plants, stars and clouds. But the next level is actually to understand where you are in a broad sense. So, you know, every time we take 10 steps, we move into a subtly different habitat. You know, there'll be more or less water there, perhaps only marginally. There'll be slightly different wind effects. There might be different nutrients in the soil. There might be different air quality. And plants and animals are sensitive to all these things. The insects are a good example. But equally, you know, grasses. You know, grass can look random. It can look like, you know, there's a patch of green stuff there. But actually, there are hundreds of different types of grasses that will, you know, tell you something about the patch of land you're on. So the best way to get into the subject is have a bit of fun, you know, test yourself and, you know, which way am I looking? But actually don't keep natural navigation in that box, because the real fun happens when we go, okay, I'm not just thinking about north, south, east and west. I can tell what's going on in my environment around me because of the patterns I'm seeing in the water. I can tell that there's something going on below the surface there because of the way these ripples are moving. I can tell there's a gust of wind because of what we call cat's paws, the way that when the wind snatches at the water's surface, I can tell that the waves are bigger in the distance there because the glitter path, when the sun or the moon's light reflects off the water, it grows broader if the waves grow bigger. So the glitter path is beautiful and practical, and it's making a map of what the water's doing for us, and it's very, very simple to read.
You have this this ancient sailor that you write about, Captain Abhara, who had this kind of deep intuition about the water. And you've described on a particular voyage that you took that he sort of haunted you along the way. Talk about the role that this Captain Abhara, what you learned from that story.
Well, the Captain Abhara story is, it's an example of perhaps a bygone age when the expert navigators and sailors and travellers of all kinds were forced through their trade to really understand what was going on around them, because there were no long-range weather forecasts, there were no tidal atlases, there was no information about what the currents were doing. You know, all of that depended on an individual learning from the generation before them and then adding their own experience to be able to look at the shape of a cloud, the colour of the water, the rhythm in the ocean, and say, okay, things are safe, or things are safe now and they're about to become dangerous. And the Abhara story is you know, the brief version is that he saves a crew from disaster by telling them to do very counterintuitive things, like saw down their mast and get rid of the anchor and things like that, because he had read these signs in the environment around him. And the story is included in the book because I came across it at a time when I'd built up my conventional nautical skills to what I considered to be quite a proficient level, and I didn't feel I'd touched any of Captain Abhara's skills. So I could print out a synoptic chart and forecast what the weather would be doing in 6 hours, 12 hours, 18 hours. I could read tidal atlases and tell you to within a few centimetres, a couple of inches, what the height of water would be at a port several hundred miles away. I could do all of those things that, you know, to become a yacht master are necessary. But I didn't feel in my gut that, you know, I frankly felt that if Captain Abhara died 1,000 years ago, but if we'd in a mythical meeting between the pair of us, I think he would have laughed at me. And I that's what I felt. So how to read water is all about how I went from having a piece of paper that told me I was a yacht master to getting to the point where I thought, you know, okay, I'm not gonna have a wager with Captain Abhara, but at least I could have a conversation with him, and I understand some of the skills he's got. And the book is all about how I collected those and how we can all enjoy them.
You write about how the finer parts of this art that used to be passed on were in fact passed on while people were still on the land, that it's actually easier in some ways to learn about water on ground rather than in a boat. Talk about that.
Yeah, I was delighted because I think we're all familiar with the idea that boats are not the easiest place to study sometimes, and swimming certainly isn't. And actually, if we look at any refined skill, we find that some of the most refined learning within it goes on when the action isn't. So if you think of, you know, almost anything you enjoy that has a high skill level, there's a sort of, you know, intense time when things are happening, and then there's a time on the side when people are, you know, unpackaging it and working out how it all works. And the beautiful thing I found with water as I was, you know, exploring all these different cultures, the Vikings, the Pacific Islanders, the Arab navigators, all of these cultures that had developed incredible skills, that they tend to pass them on through a combination of on-the-job learning and, delightfully for me, on land. So, for example, in the Pacific, we find on islands they make a stone canoe, and the student will be expected to sit on this. All it is a stone on the beach, and then smaller stones are placed around them to illustrate where the stars will rise and set. And then different patterns are made, both with stones and sticks, to illustrate the wave patterns, what they mean. So you can sense an island that you can't see once you know the patterns in the water around it. I mean, just to give you a very simple example, when you know, big waves, when swell bumps into an island, some of those waves are going to bounce back. And that sets up one pattern, the simplest pattern, you know, reflected waves meet incoming waves and set up a simple pattern. And the lovely thing is you can learn about this just by looking at a pond or even in a, you know, fountain in a city centre or something like that. These patterns can be found there. So that was a real eye-opener for me on this journey of learning how to get these skills. Was you don't have to go to the Pacific to understand how they were using these skills. You just look at there are things you can learn by looking at a bathtub. So that was very exciting for me and really helped with the writing of the book, if I'm honest.
Let me ask you this finally. You write in your books about how you try to teach people to sort of find these connections in the way a tree is bent or the way the grass moves or where lichen may be present, all these kinds of things. But you say at some point during all of this, you start to make your own connections. And that seems like that's kind of the euphoric moment that we're all looking for, is we learn And then we start to see it ourselves. And there's this really beautiful story in the book, The Natural Navigator, about where you were on this village in the south coast of England called Bosham. And you write about putting the jigsaw together and the kind of, it was just a lovely moment. I wondered if you could end with just saying something about that.
Yeah, I could list dozens of times when it's happened to me. But for your listeners, I think the broader point is more important, that we start by doing quite simple things. And the point of the book is to get people, you know, up and running. So there are actual things to look for. And that's key to my work, is that there's lots of beautiful nature writing, which sort of might give you the feeling of sharing a moment on a hill with somebody. Or but my books are slightly different in the sense that I'm saying I'm not going to be poetic here. You know, except maybe in the final paragraphs, because the poetry is much more about the sensation you will get when you use some of these techniques. Yeah. The Lost Art of Reading Nature Science has 850 examples of things you can just go out and do. And it starts as a very practical, almost plodding exercise. Oh, okay, I noticed that the trees by a river are different to the trees, you know, 200 yards away from the river. Okay. And then, you know, 3 days later, you're walking across an area you don't know terribly well. And your brain, which has evolved to do this for you, and will take these shortcuts if we just give it a tiny bit of encouragement, notice, your eyes notice, pass the information that those trees that were by the river are there. And your brain says, hello, there's a river there. And you realize you've seen a river without seeing a river. And that's very exciting. And there are literally hundreds of ways. And we have evolved to do it. We're meant to do it. It's what our brain wants to do. It'll lead us towards crime fiction and lots of other, you know, fun things if we don't let it have even more fun outdoors. But that's the poetry for me, is other people experiencing, you know, some of the fun I've been having.
It's Tristan Gooley. His latest book is called How to Read Water, Clues and Patterns from Puddles to the Sea. He joined us from a studio in the town of Arundel in Sussex, England. That's where he lives. Tristan Gooley, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.